told you before, I didn't want you to read this crap. I never saw such rotten crap in my life. Where do you get this shit? Who sells it to you? I'm talking to you, young man. You want to answer me when I'm talking to you. You remember who puts the friggin' bread on the table around here, don't you?
Stan, don't be too hard on him. All the kids read them.
My boy isn't all the kids. Want to know where this is going, Billy? In the garbage. Right into the friggin' garbage. Now, you got any smart mouth about that?
No, it's any worse than the books you keep in your dresser. Those ones under your underwear. Those sex books.
I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With a new episode every Macabre Monday, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers. The Rance Macabre, cutting,
cultured,
and curated.
So we're back for a pretty casual Friday episode installment. This time around, we're talking about anthology horror.
Holiday weekend, you know.
Yeah, Memorial Day is here. Finally. I guess it will be the day this comes out.
Yeah.
So what better way than to celebrate than to stay indoors and watch movies?
Hey, you know what?
You get the day off.
Exactly. Listen to the show, watch some movies with us, whatever.
So in the past, it's come up time and time again, the idea that we might be watching a feature film at times that feels like it had like 25 minutes of great material spread throughout a feature-length film. And at that point, we kind of recognize that, like, just let it be a short. Why couldn't this just be part of an anthology, perhaps?
Is not a lot of money in anthologies.
Yeah, I guess not.
That is why.
These days, everything would sort of go straight to the web. It would, you know, compete in like film competitions online or film festivals. But some of these go back to the early 60s, and you needed a sort of feature-length product.
Yes.
Even for a TV movie, as it goes for Trilogy of Terror. So this time around, we're going to be talking about Trilogy of Terror.
Yay!
Tales Twice Told. And already feeling some judgment. And Creepshow. That's actually how I feel about Creepshow, for the most part. We'll jump out and start with 1982's Creepshow.
Well, you know, we had a lot of fun and a lot of moments.
There were so many highlights that to look forward to and to achieve, and then to achieve it, there was happiness.
And it was innocence. We weren't yet swallowed by the studio system and by all the garbage. And, you know, we were having a good time over there, thinking that we were, you know.
I mean, it was never a job. It was,
it was
just fun, yeah.
Right.
Well, we get to build a creature, we get to kill people, we turn Stephen King into a plant, you cockroaches. I mean, you know, who you don't do this every day. No. You know?
This is set up for success. We have George Romero being the director, Stephen King being the writer. What happened?
I'm going to go out on a limb and I'm going to say cocaine.
I could see that.
Okay, so I can't speak to George Romero. I think he's like a legitimate, like, nerd. He's a simple guy, probably, whatever, he probably enjoys a party. But Stephen King, these were the days when Stephen King talks about his like lost years to booze and cocaine. Interestingly, he talked about it specifically as like a personal thing. He was not a social drinker. He was not
right.
Like a
he would lock himself
guy.
Up and just do this. Yeah.
Yeah, he would just like lose time. There was a Rolling Stone interview where he talked pretty candidly about it. When asked the question about hard drugs entering the picture, he said, it was probably about 78, around that same time, I realized that I was out of control with drinking. Well, I thought I was in control, but in reality, I wasn't. And the interviewer asked, that was cocaine? And says, yeah, coke. I was a heavy user from 78 to 86.
That's a long time.
Yeah. He says, did you write on coke? And he goes, oh, yeah, I had to. I mean, coke was different from booze. Booze, I could wait, and I didn't drink or anything, but I used coke all the time. And so that period of time from 78 to 86, that period also includes Maximum Overdrive.
Yeah. Make some explanations.
And so Creepshow being in 1982, like, this is the middle of it. And I think it shows in his segment particularly, but why don't we start at the top? The prologue and epilogue are of a young Joe Hill.
Yeah.
Who maybe it's because I know he's Stephen King's son that like He looks a lot like Stephen King, even as a little kid.
If I didn't know they were related, I don't think I would have put two and two together. Now, as an adult, he looks exactly like his father.
Yeah. And so that little kid loves himself some horror comic books, and his dad doesn't like it at all. His dad's played by Tom Atkins.
And he's the worst.
Maniac Cop, Halloween 3, and The Fog. Everybody would recognize him. He was in a ton of like 80s and early 90s movies.
Uh-huh.
His stardom puzzles me a little bit. I'm not the biggest Tom Atkins fan, I guess. He's serviceable, but...
Yeah, I don't know why he became such a thing.
I couldn't say. But in any case, he's serviceable in this as the sort of, you know...
You hate him. You love to hate him.
I guess maybe a little bit. So the film is an homage to the early EC and DC comics of the 1950s, such as House of Mystery, House of Secrets, Tales from the Crypt, The Vault of Horror, and The Haunt of Fear. And you can see those transitions in the movie. Those are some of my favorite elements.
Yeah.
As far as like the cohesive, you know, sort of structure of the movie is that of like a horror comic.
Sure.
I think Tales from the Crypt did a number of things better. The TV show, the HBO TV show I'm talking about, nailed elements of like black comedy and sort of, you know, like horror comedy.
Yeah, I think what Creepshow misses out on is there's something about Tales from the Crypt that becomes endearing when the twist happens. Mm-hmm. And in Creepshow, you're just like, that's fine. It misses it's full of kitsch, but it misses like the punchline to a lot of it.
Yeah.
It's not funny. It's just like, and it's not particularly dark. It just is this like thing.
Yeah. Even for short stories, there isn't really a great turnaround.
Right.
Yeah.
Because what I expect from Tales is there's always going to be a twist and it's going to make me laugh. It's going to be dark and it's going to be funny. Yeah. And that's what I can expect. But this is just kind of like, well, I saw that coming. Okay, great.
Yeah. Interestingly, the prop 10-cent Creepshow comic book that's featured in the movie was drawn and inked by veteran artist Jack Kamen, one of the artists for EC Comics in the 50s. So, yeah, I mean, it's authentic for good reason, because it's got one of the original guys in it. We talked a little bit about EC Comics, I guess, in our Grand Guignol episode, as far as the influence of soldiers coming from like wartime France. And being introduced to the Grand Guignol and the idea of like these macabre theater shows that, you know, played fast and loose with blood and gore and, you know, really morbid sense of humor. And then they came back to the States and started comic books that sometimes recreated entire scenes from Grand Guignol
plays. Exactly. So, I mean, it's a great history to it. And that's why I wish this was a little bit better, because there's such a great history especially, you know, with those EC comics. But it just kind of, I don't know, on the whole misses the mark.
I feel the same way.
All a bunch of dirty fighters just waiting to get your hands on my money.
He was hysterically jealous of Bedelia all his life. Complete Freudian relationship. Then when he was about 184, he had a stroke. And lucky Bedelia, she got to nurse him full time.
So let's start with Father's Day, the first segment that is your favorite.
This one is my favorite one.
Yeah.
Because I think this one to me is the silliness that I expect, kind of. It's a family that gets together once a year to celebrate Father's Day, which where their aunt murdered the mean father before, and everyone knows this story.
Right. He's meant to be like a sort of monstrous human being.
As far as you do hate him. He's terrible. And it features a very young Ed Harris, which is awesome. It features Ed Harris dancing.
I've never watched it, but Ed Harris starred in Romero's Knight Riders. It looks like a pretty wacky, like, biker gang by way of, like, Renaissance Fair crew. And Ed Harris got his start there.
That sounds like the worst thing ever.
Yeah, I mean, it only goes to explain, like, what Ed Harris is doing in a George Romero movie.
Yeah, it was a surprise to see him there. But what happens, the lady who murders the old man goes to visit his grave, and the whiskey apparently wakes him up. She spills some whiskey out there.
Not even good whiskey. It was Jim Beam.
Yeah, and it wakes him. Well, you know, this man, all he wants is cake and Jim Beam, apparently. And so he becomes this creepy zombie man who still wants his cake after all these years. Yeah. And I felt like, I think that's maybe why I like it so much, because I could relate Like, I would haunt someone's ass for some cake, for sure.
I would come back for the dead for some cake.
Yeah, give me cake. What did I write in my notes here? Ed Harris deserves the crushing. Oh, so there's a scene where Ed Harris is laying outside of the tombstone because he falls down. And he sees the obelisk or whatever coming at him.
Yeah, it's like already been shifted.
He knows it's going to come crashing down on his head.
It's a long moment.
He sits there
he's
for 5 minutes. Like, roll out of the way. So I made a note about that. He deserves it.
And the undead dad is seemingly doing it with his mind because he's behind the obelisk pushing it. He is across with his arms kind of, you know, telepathically.
Nothing makes any sense here. But I still enjoyed that. What I loved about it was the final punchline. It actually did have a punchline.
Fathers, I got my cake.
Yeah, there's pretty good gore. And so let's the special effects, I think the one place where no one could fault Creepshow is that the special effects are great.
Yeah.
And we have Tom Savini to thank for that.
Tons of practical effects here.
Yeah. In this case, the dad is played by John Amplis, who, well, with the exception of close-ups that involve maggots, because he would not get along with maggots. He refused.
I don't blame him.
They use Rice Krispies for his close-ups.
Fine. I wouldn't allow maggots on me. Could you imagine?
So John Amplis worked with Romero a bunch of times. He played the title role in Martin. And he's in Day of the Dead. He's playing the young Dr. Fisher. Kind of a forgettable part. I mean, Day of the Dead doesn't really have the most remember, except for the kind of racist characters.
Yeah, I remember those characters.
Yeah, I get that one wasn't really my.
I liked how silly it was.
It's not my least favorite of these pieces. That one's coming next.
Oh yes, me too.
Cut to the lonesome death of Jordy Verrill.
That's a meteor. I'd be dipped in shit if that ain't a meteor.
Based on King's short story Weeds, which originally published in the men's magazine Cavalier.
Listen, it's actually a pretty good story. And that's where I'll stop with that. It's starring Stephen King.
Yeah, by the sounds of it, it wasn't his idea to be in it, to act.
I mean, I would say that too, after the fact.
Yeah, I mean, this is my least favorite because of, like, just how hokey it is.
I think he was doing it on purpose to be that, like, silly, two-dimensional
on the commentary,
pulp character.
Romero talks about his direction and how he was encouraging big. He was encouraging cartoonish.
And that's what he got.
He was asking for Wile E. Coyote the moment he, like, goes off the edge and realizes that, like, gravity is about to send him down a ravine.
Yeah,
kind of
I think the choice was being fully realized. You know what I'm saying? I don't think there was, it's not bad acting. Like, that's the way it was supposed to be. I just didn't like it at all.
It's really weird to listen to the commentary because Romero is still, like, he's quite satisfied with how this one played out. Like, he likes the segment. He likes the
We've talked before about a lot of luck coming with Romero sometimes.
Yeah, for one of my favorite filmmakers, he's not one of the best filmmakers.
There is a lot of luck involved in his successes.
So that story follows Jordy Verrill, who's a farmer. He owes a lot of money. And so it's incredible luck when a meteor falls from the sky. He goes to retrieve this meteorite piece and it kind of zaps him and gives him the
blue goo all over
the
him.
The old moss virus, like,
yeah,
I don't know, from space. It's like kudzu. It just takes over everything.
Yeah. And so, to me, I wrote, this is a lesson for not putting your fingers in your mouth. Because Stephen King is always putting his fingers in his mouth, and then the next thing you know, you got moss growing in your mouth.
Yeah, Yeah, that mossy tongue gag, apparently it was a lot of fun after they called cut, and he just had a prosthetic tongue to wag at people. Again, cocaine.
The only thing I really, really liked about it, though, was the ending, because it ends so fucking dark for a silly, silly thing, and it is silly.
Yes.
The ending is so dark and awful.
The ending's great.
And it's the best part of it. That's what I'm saying. If it was a story, I would love to read that story.
I'm sure it's easy enough to find. I owe it to myself to track it down.
The
arc is great. And like you were saying, that like story is good. It comes down to a really weird choice in performance and directing. But yeah, that last moment, and you know what? It wasn't even Stephen King in that last moment. It was, I don't remember who on the cast. It wasn't Tom Savini. He talks about being like in the rafters, ready to like pull on a special effect, on a practical effect. Moss Man. Well, I don't want to say too much. I'll leave it there. But on the outro of that, when we sort of get the comic book visuals that tie everything together, it is the first appearance on screen of Castle Rock
being
made mention of, like a locality. And that's not a word.
Is locale? That a
word? Is it?
Locality? No, I don't think that's a word. I don't know. You know, I said something really stupid a couple weeks ago, so you just keep on keeping on. Keep up with me.
So loosely based on the Stephen King short, The Ledge, Something to Tide You Over is this next segment. This one's my favorite.
And I do like this one a lot.
I think a lot of people's love of Creepshow comes down to nostalgia, because I frankly don't think the quality is there in terms of like what holds up.
No.
But I think my love of this one is mostly nostalgia.
It's good.
Okay, well, let me know. I loved like the police academy that comes up later, but the Naked Gun movies.
Right.
So Leslie Nielsen was always
A comedic is good.
Guy. He is.
Oh, I thought you were gonna say like you only like him because nostalgia, but I don't think that's true. I think he's really good, and I love Ted Danson because you know what I told you,
you
I'm watching
started,
Cheers,
yeah,
you and so
from
I'm
the
all
beginning.
About some Ted Danson.
Yeah, it's funny. In my notes, I was sort of coming to terms where I was like, Ted Danson, very handsome young guy. I was like, Ted Danson, very handsome older guy.
Yeah.
I think I've got a man crush on Ted Danson.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with that. He is tall, dark, and handsome.
So Leslie Nielsen is playing it straight. And for that, like, I'm trying to think. He popped up in something I watched not that long ago. Maybe it was like an old episode of The Twilight Zone or something like that. But as a straightforward actor, he's great.
Yeah.
He's a fine actor. It's funny to read that, like, after they yelled cut, it was all about fart machines and pranks on set, that, like, he likes a real simple gag. And for that, he literally had, like, a device that made fart noises.
I could see that. It's like dad humor.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Keeping things light on the set.
I could see, though, Ted Danson being really irritated by things like that.
I don't know. I couldn't speak to... He apparently... They were, like, broken up in between set. Or he would, like, use the fart machine just before they yelled action. And so he was sort of... Yeah, it's not the most professional thing. So Ted Danson might not have loved that. I guess this is pre-Cheers,
yeah.
Right? This is 82. Cheers was not long after, but... In any case, so the story really just features the two of them, and on camera we get the sort of in-between love interest that makes up the love triangle.
Right.
And Leslie Nielsen plays a great, like murderous, jealous husband.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, like, I think that's why the segment works.
Now look, this has gone just about far enough.
No, Harry, not nearly far enough. Now, if you're thinking of becoming a hero, I suggest that you remember the lady fair. Jump into that hole.
He's great. The reason this works is because they play it straight. And while there's a little bit, I wasn't wild about like the
ending. That's where this one, like, yeah. Kind. That's why it's not my favorite, because I do not like the ending.
Yeah, I think this one works best when Leslie Nielsen is in the like revenge mode. Mm-hmm. And for that, so it's not spoiling too much, but to say that Leslie Nielsen's wife was the object of affection of Ted Danson, the like much younger suitor. And so when Leslie Nielsen finds out, he decides to punish them both.
Right.
And he does so using the beach. And he was a very early adapter to like streaming video.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was surprised like that they could do all this in 1982.
I don't think they could. I think they were kind of playing fast and loose with the technology of the time. But all the same, it's pretty great to have like a villain watching and rewatching. That was a creepy element when they show his like shelves of videotapes.
Yeah.
That was indicative of some like really nasty history. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And also that marble ashtray.
Yeah. That marble ashtray that they used to kill the dead on Father's Day makes an appearance in each of the segments.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a conspicuous. I was trying to think how to describe the shape. But in any case, yeah, the ashtray comes up in each of these parts. It's weird that like that attention to detail found its way into these segments.
It's like the only thing they have in common. The next one, number four, is The Crate, starring Adrienne Barbeau being drunk and hilarious.
Yeah, she's good.
Loving her.
Yeah.
Oh, Henry, can't you do anything right?
Huh?
Huh? That's what I figured. Huh? That's just what I'd expect from you. I told you half an hour ago to get one of them kids in the monkey suits to bring the car around.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, Henry, you are such a little kid. I swear to God you are. I mean, where would you be without me to take care of you?
Yeah. And that's about it. Hal Holbrook being the, like, what is that, doormat kind of husband?
Yeah, the henpecked husband. Like, you wonder why in the hell they ever got together in the
first
place.
Because Adrienne Barbeau is gorgeous.
I guess, you've got, like, the older man and younger wife suitor, and,
she's just so loud and obnoxious, and I love how she acts at the party in the very beginning.
Oh, God.
And everyone hates her.
The public embarrassment is so cringeworthy.
And Hal Holbrook, he's just a doofus. Like, he always kind of plays, like, the doofus. And he's so embarrassed, and you're embarrassed for him.
Yeah, you kind of live through his, like, his daydreams of revenge.
Yeah.
And then we get introduced to The Crate. Hal Holbrook is playing an academic, and I guess it's his friend who receives the giant mysterious crate
under the stairs.
Yeah, seems to have been forgotten.
It's not even for him, exactly. It's just like the janitor's like, I found this box. You interested?
It's not addressed to you. You want to open it?
Yeah, and then he's like, yeah, I do. Thanks.
That's illegal. It's a federal offense to open someone's mail.
Crate or not. From 1864 or something.
Is that what it was from?
The date is like from the 1800s.
I saw an image. I don't know its veracity. If it looked like it could have been bad Photoshop, but apparently in an episode of The Walking Dead, they stamp a crate in the scene with the same address too.
Oh, like, really?
It's the whole, coming from this and such place to their address to this person, attention to. So yeah, I don't know. That's just like a web sort of Easter egg kind of thing you could look for. But inside the crate, we know it's Fluffy in there.
terrible effect.
Yeah, it's
terrible. Monster.
It gets a little too much screen time to really work.
So yeah, if all you saw were his hands or maybe his eyes, which at the beginning all you're introduced to are his
eyes.
When he gets the janitor, that's all you see, and it's great.
Yeah, and that's when it's working best, is when it is off camera in the shadows in a tucked away corner. And so, yeah, so Fluffy is the name Tom Savini gave it. This was his first animatronic work. And for that, I thought it was very cool as far as notes. And he talks about in the commentary that he got on the phone with Rob Bottin, who did The Thing, because there's a man with experience in, like, animatronic creature effects. And so that said, Fluffy, I think, opens its mouth, moves its eyes a little bit, but it's a pretty limited range of motion.
Yeah.
This is mostly
something
teeth.
It should not have had so much screen time, and it would have been fine.
Yeah.
I think it was one of those things, though, that this was so new and so like exciting that maybe in 82 that was cool.
Yeah.
And then we see it now and go like, no, come on, get the fuck out of here. You know?
Yeah.
Like it does not age well.
Yeah. Less is more, Romero. But in this case, Hal Holbrook I guess he's really like the last guy to the party. Like, it's already sort of it's had a couple meals. It does seem to prefer the box, so it does kind of return.
Like what you know.
Yeah, for it's like however many years it was in there.
Probably comforting.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I find my way to my bed even when I'm not sleeping. but so Hal Holbrook kind of thinks, two birds and one stone. I got this awful wife I want to dispatch. Why don't I see what the monster thinks of her?
Right. And he might think she's delicious.
Yeah. Adrienne Barbeau, at this point, like, even the audience is so excited to watch her be dispatched. Because in his daydreams, we've already seen it happen a couple times.
Right, right.
And, yeah, I don't know. It's funny that, like, I love Adrienne Barbeau. And, you know, she's great in The Fog and any number of John Carpenter's
things.
She's
funny in this, though.
Yeah, this is range. This is a different role than she's ever played.
She's so obnoxious. I do love her in this, but that's all I can say about that.
Yeah, this was not my favorite, but I guess nor is the next segment coming up.
I thought the last segment, they're creeping up on you, is actually the scariest one.
Air pollution counts up to almost 7, George.
Oh,
people are out there on the streets dying of carbon monoxide poisoning, and they don't even know it.
Yes, sir. But
I found another cockroach this evening, George.
Oh, no.
One of those big ones, right here in my $3,200 a month penthouse apartment. My supposedly germ-proof apartment. Now, would you like to tell me, George, how an apartment can be germ-proof when it's not even bug-proof?
The cockroaches scare the shit out of me.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. So this is a story of a sort of old xenophobic racist sort of bigoted Howard Hughes kind of character who's isolated in his ivory tower
somewhere in New York.
Yeah, it's completely sterile, and that's kind of the point. And so when it does become infested with cockroaches, it's like a biblical plague on his house.
But it's because they were in him, because he's evil and his personality is made of cockroaches.
He's filled with evil cockroaches.
Yeah, I don't know, I thought this one out of all of them was the scariest one.
It definitely got the ick response from me more than any of the other stories.
Right.
I think it's got some great visuals that still kind of make my skin crawl to think about it.
Yeah.
And yeah, there are interesting stories as far as the wrangling those many cockroaches, because you probably noticed that like the vast majority of those cockroaches weren't the kind of cockroaches that you see now in movies, where like
they were all different kinds of cockroaches.
There were a couple, but they were mostly like the small water bug style.
That's the
cockroaches.
Worst kind. Okay, so here, I gotta explain something to the listeners, because water bug is a pretty New York thing.
It's a pretty innocuous term for
it's a thing.
Bug.
I learned when I moved here is that people call cockroaches water bugs when they don't want to acknowledge that they're cockroaches, and they act like they're a different thing altogether, that cockroaches and water bugs are not the same creature. But they are. And outside of New York, I think no one else uses that stupid terminology.
Yeah, it could have only
been... It's just a little cockroach.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a phobia.
Oh. You know,
so that...
this movie
telling me.
This movie gave me a fear of roaches.
I never picked one. Did you ever pick one of those roaches
I was
up?
Never in the
these
same
guys,
room.
These guys, the entomologists would go... Like in these scenes where there was only one roach...
Right.
They'd come in and just pick it up like it was a pretty pet cat or something. And they'd say, here, hold this for a minute. And I'd say, not me.
Just the idea of those legs. The idea of those scurrying legs on you.
Yeah, you just don't want to have that in your hand, you know, all that scratching. And what they did was they used, CO2 to sort of slow them down.
Just to kind of make them a little...
Sort of make them a little groggy.
The cold.
For shots that when we needed... them to like
stay
be
still
on, be right. on his robe for a
right.
while
they would it would slow them down
slow
the
them
cold
down.
Would slow them down yeah
so they would move but they weren't you know because boy when they move when they're without the CO2 when they move they're gone and you know
I think I remember them actually putting them in a refrigerator freezer and then taking out like a tray or a Tupperware thing of them and they would be slower you know
yeah.
But, you know, we should talk about the entomologists. They actually went to Trinidad and collected like 18 or more thousand roaches and bred.
Give me a break. 250,000.
Ah. And they would breed them in this trailer that we spoke about earlier. The trailer was called the Roach Motel.
The Roach Coach.
And they collected these roaches by digging big holes in bat guano batshit in caves in Trinidad. Turn off the lights, the hole would fill up, turn the lights back on, load them into plastic bags, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, they sent photographs back where they were waist deep in roaches. I mean, just this sea of, like the last scene in this story, they were just that deep.
That deep.
And apparently back then you couldn't rent cockroaches.
Now, I have a question too, because there was some squishing of the cockroaches, and then I wondered in 1982, was that allowed? I don't think it's allowed nowadays. Is that a true statement or
not? I don't know how much, like, the it's not the ASPCA, but like whatever the animal
people, you can't have that announcement at the end, like,
right?
No cockroaches were injured.
Insects, because they straight up smashed cockroaches.
Yeah,
and in this I think the biggest crime in Romero's eyes is probably like, hey, man, we had to pay for those. Listen to the commentary. It's pretty unsettling.
So for me, this was the scariest, though, because the ick factor was there.
Yeah, and I dug that. But again, I felt it was a little one note as far as like this particular segment. It's got some great visuals. Not great dummy work towards the end, but the concept is pretty horrifying. That last visual will stay with you. And then we cut back to a young Joe Hill sort of taking revenge on his dad who punished him, and Tom Savini makes a little cameo as a garbage man with the headphones. That's Creepshow. It's kind of it's got its moments, but overall I wouldn't.
I felt like when I watched it as a kid, it was better.
It wasn't everything.
Yeah, it's true.
So someone who has come up on this podcast a number of times, even though I don't think we've actually addressed one of the movies that she's in. She's always your fantasy casting.
Yeah, I'd put her in anything. I think she's great.
So Karen Black in Trilogy of Terror, but you've got some background. I wanted a little bit of insight as to where this adoration came from.
Well, firstly, okay, so here's my notes. No, the people can't see them, but I have Karen Black, and then I drew a bunch of hearts on
it looks
there.
Looks like a MASH note.
I think she's amazing. She grew up, she's from Illinois. Just like me. She grew up in a Chicago suburb, died a few years ago. But what I think is amazing about her, she attended Northwestern University at 15.
At 15? Wow.
Yeah. And her sister is also an actor who looked very similar to her. She was on a soap opera like As the World Turns or something like that.
Okay.
And her last name was Brown. Her sister was Gail Brown.
Real?
Karen Black, Gail Brown.
That's funny.
Real name Ziegler, but they took their husband's names at the time. And Karen Black started as a theater actor, and that's what she did. She did Broadway, things like that, and where she first kind of broke out was Five Easy Pieces. I think that's you think of Karen Black, you think of Five Easy Pieces.
Yeah, with Jack Nicholson.
I mean, I think, you could say Easy Rider, but she's the girl in the cemetery in Easy Rider. She's like the prostitute. But you really know her from Five Easy Pieces. And from that, she won a Golden Globe. She was nominated for an Oscar. Directly following that, she was in Great Gatsby. She won a Golden Globe for that. So she was on this kind of specific trajectory in 1970 and in the 70s. And I think why I like her so much is she comes about at a time with people like Sissy Spacek and Ellen Burstyn. And what I love about it is that she's unusual.
Yeah.
She had a different look. And that's the same thing with Sissy Spacek and stuff. And it was that the talent spoke before the looks or whatever.
I guess these days she'd be relegated to character actor status.
She's a person who just came about at the right place, the right time.
It's a funny thing. I think she's very attractive.
I think she's gorgeous. And Five Easy Pieces, she's like smoking. I don't know. She was on this great trajectory. And what I really liked it is she went off and did Trilogy of Terror. She did Burnt Offerings. Mm. And then she kind of said I could do this Hollywood thing. And she did, but she did just weird things. Burnt Offerings was not a normal role. That was not a normal thing for someone to do, especially on her trajectory of what she was kind of going to be doing.
I haven't seen Burnt Offerings.
It's horror. Okay. It's the same person as Trilogy of Terror.
Director.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And so you don't come off playing like Jack Nicholson's love interest and then suddenly you're doing horror. And even into the 90s, she's doing a Corey Haim movie, a silly Corey Haim movie. She does House of a Thousand Corpses. And I just love that.
Yeah, I could see
she
Rob
just
Zombie
did
being a
stuff
huge
that
fan.
Was fun. Yeah. I think that's why I love her so much. She just did what she thought was interesting.
Yeah. I don't know if it made the cut, but we, when talking about Evil Bong 5 last week, we mentioned that she has a small role in that director's earlier film, Ooga Booga.
Yeah.
Which definitely takes its character from the Zuni fetish doll that we'll talk about in a couple of minutes. But yeah, her role, it's a comedic one. It's a very silly one.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. It was nice to see her getting work up to I mean
this girl never wanted for work. Yeah. She amazing number of credits, and it's not a person that she's doing anything for a dollar. It's that she loved working and she was an interesting actor. Even in the movie Nashville, she sang and wrote the songs for that. Everyone in that movie sang and wrote the songs. And so she was even nominated for a Grammy because she was on that that album. So it's like, hey, that's pretty freaking cool. You know, she has Golden Globes. She was nominated for an Oscar, nominated for a Grammy. She won like a Fango Award, the Chainsaw Award. It's just very cool.
Yeah. She had a big part in writing at least the last segment, the Zuni, all the segments of Trilogy of Terror named after the characters that are in them. And the last segment is Amelia. And apparently she had a big part in rewriting the dialogue, because that it's essentially like a one woman play that last segment. Well, one and a half, I guess.
Well, she's no slouch, studied acting at Northwestern, and she's really funny about the way she would study characters. And I thought this was really good. I don't know if you've seen Five Easy Pieces, but the character she plays is kind of like dumb. If you watch it on the surface level, she's stupid. But she says about Rayette, she's not dumb. She's just not into thinking. And I thought that's like so smart, because as an actor, you can't pass judgment on your character
or it
doesn't work, you know? And I think, especially with Trilogy of Terror, each one is so well thought out and well acted.
Yeah.
She is holding this entire movie.
Trilogy of Terror, I was surprised to hear that she was cast after her husband at the time, Robert Burton, because she is the whole point. The Trilogy of Terror kind of plays like an acting reel for her specifically.
Absolutely.
Because she covers all the bases from beginning to end.
Okay, so let's get into this. Trilogy of Terror, 1975, obviously starring the great Karen Black, directed by Dan Curtis, stories by Richard Matheson.
Yeah.
And it was originally a TV movie.
Yeah, it played on ABC in the days where, like, if you were lucky, you had four channels.
Right.
And so it doesn't happen anymore where there's something that just cuts across all of culture where millions of people watch something at the same time and then show up to work the next day and
talk
about
it.
And
yeah.
That it was on TV meant a lot of kids saw this on television.
It's amazing. The teleplay is written by William Nolan, who did Logan's Run.
Yeah, yeah, the novel. Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, I love that.
Yeah,
I love that story.
Producer, director Dan Curtis had a big part in producing and writing Dark Shadows over the years.
Yep.
Yeah.
Each of the titles of each of these short films is based on the woman, which is Karen Black.
Yeah.
And the first one we have is Julie, which is dark as hell.
It is.
You think it's going one way that's incredibly dark and horrible, and then it goes another way that's maybe worse and dark and horrible.
Yeah. It was so dark and twisted. I'm not sure I'm along for the logic of it.
I loved it so much.
I appreciated the twist. Okay, so her husband, Robert Burton, who they divorced that year, the same 1975.
Right.
He plays her college student. She is an English professor. And
they always keep making her look terrible.
Yeah.
Like, they make her look terrible. Every single one of these, they make her look like not that great.
Well, I thought in the last one, the Zuni fetish doll, she looks fine
until
she
the end. Look,
well, yeah.
So, but in this one, she's got her hair up and she's wearing glasses, so then you know she's studious.
I wasn't sure where they were going from it. It's funny, I don't think I'd ever watched Trilogy of Terror from beginning to end before. You know,
everyone
for this
knows Amelia. You know, everyone right. knows the last one.
But so watching this for the first time. Her character, yes, is kind of frumpy, deliberately so. Her roommate, I mean, it kind of plays with like a she's all that scenario where like her roommate tells her, hey, if you made an effort, you'd be really pretty.
Exactly. Which is, and they're making her be like, God. She's like ancient too. And at the time, Karen Black was like 36 years old.
Is that right?
Yeah. But they make her like look so terrible.
So Robert Burton is playing Chad, her college student, who
becomes obsessed with her,
oozes scumbaggery.
Yeah.
That said, he asks out Karen Black, his teacher.
Yeah.
And she says yes.
That scene in Sanctuary where Faulkner has his character Popeye rape the girl. I prefer Fitzgerald. He only suggests violence.
Well, Faulkner was just telling it like it is. I guess some people enjoy violence, lead perverted lives. And speaking of perversion, there's a wonderful old vampire pic playing down at the Village Drive-In this Friday. It's all in French with English subtitles. It's a real classic. How about going to see it with me? For reasons of cultural expansion.
Well, I thank you, Chad, but you know, teachers aren't allowed to date students. Or didn't you know that?
So who'll find out? My lips are sealed. I won't tell.
Like, there is a miracle scenario that could only be made horribly if Chad is a monster. And it's not, like, he beat the odds. She said, yes, she's going to go out on a date with him.
Yeah.
And then he's going to date rape her? Like, this
yeah,
is,
he's going to roofie her.
Oh, God.
Then he's going to take scandalous pictures of her.
Because photography is his hobby.
Yeah, he's using now the pictures as blackmail.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, like 1975, this is on TV.
Oh yeah.
And they're not making it funny. Like, haha. Like, what was that movie we recently watched where the Blob, where it's like funny date rape, you know?
The like hand in the shirt. Okay.
Yeah. And it's supposed to be so silly. Ha ha ha. And you're like, that's not silly, but someone seemed to think it was. In this, it's not silly. It is dark, and it is exactly a face value for what's going on.
Yeah. So I don't know how much more we can say without really talking about twists, but we'll say that her character was far more deliberate than we ever expected.
Yeah.
And so that lends to a pretty great twist. That said, I think it's asking a lot of suspended disbelief.
So we just had a conversation offline. Just so the listener knows, we had to hit pause for a second and have a conversation about this film because I had to explain to Darren how good it was.
I hadn't thought of the depths of depravity.
Yes.
And motivations on people's parts. But all right, now I'm on board. It's profoundly fucked up.
It's really fucked up. 1975 right, TV.
Yeah.
Certain fantasies.
Yeah, it was. Kids watch this. Yeah, that was.
There's so many levels
to think about.
Yeah. So I encourage everyone to watch it. It's really messed up. Also, though, Chad does have a beautiful car. I would date him for that car.
Yeah, well, I mean, he seemed to be like 38 years old, so he's had some time to save as a college student.
On this night when father is barely cold in his casket, I ran some old family films to remind myself of when it began. Even then, at 12, she was already using her wiles on him. Poor mother, so weak, so innocent, never suspecting the depth of evil in Therese. My spoiled sister, her sweet little face never fooled me for an instant. I knew the darkness behind it. I knew the fermenting ugliness in her soul.
Second story in Trilogy of Terror is Millicent and Therese. It's very ominous sounding. No, it's not. But yes, it's the story of these two sisters. It harkens a little bit to like whatever happened to Baby Jane as far as these two sisters who are you know, kind of alone to grow up in this mansion.
Right.
And
one's
then...
a goober, one's beautiful. And again, they're making Karen Black look like shit.
Yeah. A lot of these stories come down to like how to best torture Karen Black psychologically.
Yeah, let's make her look
physically.
Terrible.
Yeah.
So there's a twist to this film that everyone will figure out in the first like minute. Literally, my first note is the twist.
Yeah. Yeah. I felt like present day, anybody who's watched enough TV, anybody who's watched enough movies or read enough books, specifically genre stuff, like you see it coming a mile away.
Yeah.
So it kind of, yeah, this one kind of falls flat. I did enjoy seeing George Gaines, who previously was a commandant in the Police Academy movies, and he's also Punky Brewster's adopted dad.
He's a psychologist in this.
Yeah, he's a psychologist, or he's like the family physician?
I thought he was a psychologist. Because I think that's how he's involved with both the sisters.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know.
I noticed
there's a lot going on. There's a lot of mental illness going on. There's actually nail clippings that are left in an ashtray. That's apparently like a thing that happens.
That was a weird move. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny to think that like 1975, you just had ashtrays around. Whether you smoked or not, you just had ashtrays. It was like an airplane. You just had ashtrays in case anybody needed them.
Put your nails in there too. Your nail clippings. Whatever. It's how you make your voodoo dolls. I thought that there's this scene where the doctor comes to the house and Therese is like passed out because she's also a raging alcoholic, Therese. And she seems like fun, actually. Therese is the fun one. And he's going to check her pulse, but it's like the weirdest, most awkward angle because you know the director was like, don't put your arm in front of this because you're going to block her face. And so it's like the most awkward pulse checking that I've ever seen ever. I don't think he's a real doctor.
It's a Zuni hunting fetish. It's really interesting. There's supposed to be some Zuni hunter's spirit inside of it. And there's a golden chain wrapped around it to keep the spirit from making the doll come to life.
The last one is probably the one when anyone thinks of Trilogy of Terror, this is the one they think of. It's Amelia, based on Prey by Richard Matheson, featuring obviously Karen Black and a Zuni fetish doll.
Yeah, this is like, this would almost work as like a black box theater sort of one setting sketch because it's entirely in her apartment. Considering she spends a lot of time on the phone with her mom and I think a little with the boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
It's just Karen Black holding the screen for the entire segment.
I mean, when you say like, why do you love Karen Black? Like she's carrying this whole film.
Yeah.
Not only just this section, but she carries the entire show, but this whole section is her in her room or her in her apartment.
It's a testament to her that in these conversations, specifically the long one with her mom, we absorb a lot of their relationship that she is kind of the put upon daughter who's finally left.
I couldn't call earlier. I just got home. Mother, it's about tonight. I know we always spend Friday night together, but I thought... No, I feel all right. It's not that. Mother, I'm not sick. Mother, there's a man. His name is Arthur Breslow. He's a teacher at City College. It's his birthday. And, well, I sort of promised him that we'd spend the night, the evening together.
And so, you know, we see all this on Karen Black's face, and those are fascinating elements that, like, when someone's on the phone, everything you don't see lends so much, and that we only get that one side. Yeah, it was really impressive on her part that we see the whole range of that relationship by just watching her side. And, you know, we hear a little bit of her mom, a little bit, but for the most part, it's just Karen Black.
So she has this boyfriend, and it's his birthday, and she goes out and buys him a gift. Now, there are a million stores all over New York that are these, like, holes in the wall that you expect that there's a Mogwai in them. If they're open late at night, you're like, I bet I could buy a Mogwai here.
Yeah.
And she goes to one of those stores.
Curio shop.
Yeah. There's like,
I've never heard the term before.
In Murray Gremlins. Hill, there's, like, a million. And it's, like, Needful Things, like, anywhere you walk. And that's where she finds this Zuni fetish doll where the spirit is supposed to be kept in by this gold chain.
It's very convenient of the maker of the Zuni fetish doll to include a scroll yes, written in English.
That
she reads to her mom. So now we're on board. We know that the spirit of a Zuni warrior is trapped in this body, held at bay by a magical gold charm sort of bracelet around his waist. It's a pretty dick move to like make a doll whose only safeguard is a really flimsy gold chain that comes off when it's not even being touched.
I know. No good there. And so, yes, the chain comes off and the doll comes to life.
And I love that it is a slow burn. The audience knows it's on the loose. She does not. She doesn't know anything's up. She just knows it's missing. It probably fell under the couch.
Right.
And so the like slow build up.
I love how she's talking to herself and talking to the doll. Like,
yeah,
it's so natural.
It really is.
It's a bizarre situation. It's a bizarre. What do I want? It's a bizarre scene that she's like put in, but she makes it really natural.
Yeah, and it does feel like any moment where, you know, we're just living our lives off camera, all of us. And so like when something happens that we're not sure about, like when we're talking to ourselves, right, like, come on, dummy, put it together. Where could it be? And that kind of stuff, just talking to herself. Yeah. Yeah. I guess it'll come full circle as far as the talk of the characters that she inhabits, so to speak. But yeah, when she's on the phone with her mom, when she's on her own, like these are all facets of a like a well thought through character.
Yeah.
So I've mentioned in the past, I don't like little stabby creatures.
Sure.
The pitter patter of little footsteps concept skeeves me out.
Okay, but so yeah, I mean it's similar to cockroaches, you know.
Yeah, but different when it's a small person. So like, Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, the remake that Guillermo del Toro produced, where you've got like tooth fairy creatures wielding straight razors, like that kind of thing. Like, I'm paranoid on the level of someone who has had their Achilles tendon cut. Like, it's that kind of sensitivity where like, stay away from my ankles, stay away from my feet. Like, that terrifies me.
Yeah. I mean, just hit him with a shoe or something.
Or towel turns out to be a really good defensive weapon.
Exactly.
Yeah. But when it's unleashed, I mean, there's the initial shock of what in God's name is happening.
That's true. That's true. The panic, the initial panic is,
I grew up having my dad imitate the noise that the Zuni fetish doll made.
So my mom is obsessed with this movie because she watched it when she was in high school, and her sister would always be making that noise, that noise. But yeah, this is one that still my aunts and my mother will still make that noise.
It's one of the classic settings, and why I had seen this segment, but I had no memory of the other ones. Like, this is the one on the poster. This is the one that people remember. Yeah, Karen Black. I wonder how much we can sort of say about the end.
I mean, I feel like we can't really say anything about the end.
Right.
But it's beautifully acted. I can say it's beautifully acted.
If memory serves, the like great tag punch at the end was Karen Black's idea.
Well, it's the most brilliant part of the film.
Yes. Yeah. I think this movie, any other actress in her parts, and this would not have been the classic we think of today. I don't know. I dug this one. Certainly more than Creepshow.
Yeah. I think all three are pretty solid. The middle lags a little bit, but it's kind of interesting in that the middle does deal with this weird incestuous relationship, which I thought on TV, that's bizarre to bring up.
Yeah, they're playing with a couple of taboos. I mean, the last one is closer to like a monster story, but the first two are pretty scandalous.
They're sexual.
Think that, like, if it played maybe at 9 o'clock at night, those first two segments are still playing to a huge audience.
I think if I saw it though today on TV, I would be like, "That's really scandalous," because it's some real sexual deviance going on in both of them.
Yeah, yeah. Either, on screen and alluded to.
Yeah.
The next movie in this anthology segment is far and away my favorite of all of these.
Really?
Yeah. Twice Told Tales from 1963. Now, I first came upon this when we were originally doing a Roger Corman Poe cycle.
Right.
This was actually the opposite. This was like the B-side of a DVD I got from Netflix where Tales of Terror was what I got it for. And in that one, you know, Vincent Price is acting in a couple different Poe stories. Uh-huh. That said, Twice Told Tales is the far better anthology movie between the two.
Yeah, I mean, yes, between the two, yes. Yes, yeah. You're right. I don't know. I mean, I think Vincent Price could do anything, honestly, and be entertaining. He's a class act.
And they were definitely capitalizing. This is sort of midway through the bulk of the Roger Corman Poe cycle. So, you know, people thought of Vincent Price as part of, you know, a fixture of these movies.
Right.
And they were definitely capitalizing on the sort of familiarity. And it did follow the year after Tales of Terror. So even the anthology format was something that we had already seen him perform in as far as the AIP pictures. But so Twice Told Tales is named after the collection by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Only one of the stories is actually from that original collection. Everything else were individual novels. Nathaniel Hawthorne, people will know from The Scarlet Letter. And I liked how they described his style as a dark romanticism.
Yeah.
Which some of these stories even venture into sort of like early sci-fi. Yeah. I found the Grolier Club, a private society of bibliophiles named Twice Told Tales, the most influential book of 1837.
That seems so fancy. I don't think we would be allowed in that group.
No, I certainly don't read enough.
Like, well, we have a podcast called Rance Macabre.
Ever heard of Oprah's Book Club?
And that's why we wouldn't have been invited. Does that club still exist?
I think so. They have a building, I think, here in Manhattan. Directed by Sidney Salco, who would go on to direct Vincent Price in The Last Man on Earth, another Richard Matheson story, the I Am Legend / Omega Man story. Apparently not anyone's favorite of that
I don't think
story.
I've actually seen it.
I've seen
obviously like Omega Man. Oh, we should do an episode on that.
We should. There's enough versions of it. I remember your dad very specifically hating the Vincent Price Last Man on Earth version.
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably why I never saw it. It wasn't allowed. Don't watch that garbage.
These stories don't have much of like a wraparound component. Mm-hmm. The only running theme is that these are all period pieces. And I think that actually lends a lot to the cohesive element of like why these stories work together. And again, like Vincent Price, actually that's why everything works, is because Vincent Price ties them together. And the consummate professional, like, he plays everything straight.
Right.
And when he does sort of go into villainous territory, like, that's when it gets real good.
Yeah.
This liquid absolutely defies analysis. It looks like water. It tastes like water, but it isn't water, at least not as man knows it.
Man, you can drink that if you like. I need something more familiar. Whiskey.
The first segment is Dr. Heidegger's experiment, which, if memory serves, it was the only one originally in Twice Told Tales. It involves Vincent Price and his longtime friend. There's the sort of running through line is that of like friends retrospectively looking at their lives and sort of pondering their mortality and the sort of lost youth and
right.
You know, the lives they've lived. Heidegger has lost his wife by now. It's long ago. They were, you know, she was a young bride. And so when this terrible storm kind of comes upon the estate and blows the door off a mausoleum, which, how often does that happen?
I mean, it's a hell of a storm. Hell of a storm here.
They go to check it out and see that everything's still copacetic, where they find like a mineral rich drip.
Yes.
has been sort of dripping into his wife's coffin. And so that is soaked and wet, and there inside, it's kind of a morbid impulse to been, check it out
yeah,
at that
yeah.
point, but they give it a look.
Because you kind of know what's going to, because it's been a while. She's been dead for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, the smell enough would be reason to
really
stay the hell
bad.
Away.
Really pretty bad.
But there and inside, she is, like, the day she died, she is
clothes
young.
Still and, look nice. Everything's
I mean,
fine.
Lucky for them, they didn't embalm in those days yeah, because that would have complicated the story.
Oopsies. So, yeah, they find this kind of, like, elixir of youth.
Yeah.
In this water.
And Heidegger, it's fun that, like, this story is meant to take place in the 1800s, but, you know, he's got an early microscope to analyze the water sample and doesn't really have a good set. Like, he knows it's not a common, you know, mixture.
Right.
This elixir that is dripped through the ceiling. But it's clearly responsible for his wife looking young still.
Yes.
And so I'm trying to think. He drinks it, right? He takes it orally.
Yes.
Initially. And so this all happens in one night.
It's I guess that they same had been idea drinking. Of just
they
like,
had. They had,
they
been,
had
drinking.
Been drinking. But it's like never going to. Don't put stuff in your mouth, everybody. Everyone keep stuff out of your mouth.
And it's a pretty great transition effect going from old age makeup. I wasn't wild about the like grayish hair. But other than that, like the face transition and the makeup effects. Really great for 1962,
yeah.
where we watch Heidegger go from, you know, older, wrinkled, chubby guy. He's still chubby at the end of the transition. But
you watch your mouth.
But completely youthful and reinvigorated. And so now sky's the limit as far as
But he also
they're
changes
concerned.
Even the way he's acting, the personality, everything
spry.
About it.
Yeah,
yeah, spry is a good word for it.
I guess Vincent Price is not too far behind as far as wanting to recapture that youth they were just talking about earlier that evening. And when things continue to spiral and they give his, well, not Vincent Price's wife, Heidegger's wife, an injection of this elixir and she reanimates,
mm-hmm.
now we're off to the races. Now things are going to get interesting as far as everything that happened before she died.
So let's just say sometimes... You should leave your dead wife dead.
Pet
Probably
cemetery has taught
every
us
time.
Anything.
Yeah, every time you should leave your dead wife dead. You won't like the things she has to say.
No. And when people die and take their secrets with them, it's generally for the best.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't push too much. I did love hearing Sebastian Cabot. Great voiceover actor. And I guess you see him in this too. But you know him from, you know, a lot of Winnie the Pooh stuff. And he's just that great English voice. That great voice actor. And it was nice kind of to hear him. He's from a few Disney things too. Like The Jungle Book. And he was also in Sword in the Stone. And he was Kris Kringle in Miracle on 34th Street. It's just one of these voices that as soon as you hear the voice, your ears are like, oh, I know who that is. Like, why do I know this guy?
Yeah.
So it was good to see him, actually.
Yeah, the two
I
of
really
them together are great. Yeah.
I couldn't, like, put a face to the voice, you know? Vincent Price could be in a scene with anybody, though, and make something really, really great happen.
Yeah, he's one of those actors that they talk about, like...
He's very
raising
generous.
Raising everyone else's level. Yeah. The next story is Rappaccini's Daughter, which is kind of a mix of, like... Rapunzel and Romeo and Juliet
definitely yeah.
This was the one I was thinking of when I talked about like early sci-fi because well you know what Heidegger's experiment does involve science if not pseudoscience
sort of
but Rappaccini's Daughter is kind of the story of like a loving father mad scientist
mm-hmm.
and
I think he's a very loving father.
Yeah, I mean, he's too loving is the problem.
Yeah.
He's possessive.
Your daughter's a fine specimen, too, is she not, Father? A specimen of the most deadly thing that was ever given life.
The day will come when you will thank me.
I particularly like the visuals in this. There are a couple, like, subtle practical effects that I think are really effective,
mm-hmm.
Especially for the time, considering. But, so, Rappaccini's daughter, I think I have the... actress here, Joyce Taylor as Beatrice Rappaccini, who stunning, really, really well. So she's like a kept daughter. She has access to Rappaccini's mansion and the courthouse garden where, you know, she does come into view of the local fella who's in from like Italy.
Yes.
He's about as Italian as I don't know if you remember in trying to think which of the Poe movies it was, but one of the characters shows up and they're like, I'm fresh in from Italy. It's like,
and you're like, where's that American accent coming from?
Right, like Midwest, maybe, but that's way west. In this case, so the fella, he's an academic that, you know, he's sort of appeals to her that way. You know, Beatrice is definitely homeschooled.
Yes, she's very sheltered.
So they have conversations in the sort of Romeo and Juliet, like speaking from the like windowsill down, except in verse this time around, where Beatrice is on the ground floor. Always pretty close to the really curious, like, purple thistle bush.
Yes.
It's such a curious, and I'm sure it's, you know, mostly created for the segment, because, you know, it's not any plant I recognize other than thistles.
Yeah, do have like a purple flower.
Oh, do they?
Yeah. Not like the ones in your yard, but yeah, thistles have like a purple flower, but not like that. That's like an extravagant
one. And playing pretty fast and loose with like the science terms they throw around, because initially it seems the plant radiates radioactivity. It seems like proximity is the issue. And then later he describes it as the acid's radiation. It's like, acid is chemical. That's not how that works. As the story unfolds, we kind of learn that the daughter is one part like mortal daughter and another part like the product of a mad scientist who, you know, as a protective dad, wants her sort of isolated from the rest of the dangerous world.
Yes.
And one way to do that is to make her like Rogue from the X-Men.
Yes, I totally thought about Rogue when I was watching this.
You saw the butterfly die when it touched that plant.
Yes.
You would die if you touched me.
What kind of nonsense is that? Why should you and that plant?
This is what you must understand.
Yeah, so she's got a lot in common with the plant. And, you know, now that the male suitor is in the picture, like, he wants more FaceTime. And so things escalate from there. I really liked the narrative in this one. I thought as far as short segments that have like a great arc, I was really impressed by this.
It's a cool story. And I think for 63, this idea is very cool. I think now, though, we've kind of seen this kind of idea especially with Rogue, something like that. But I don't think it's that original now, but I bet in 1963 it was really new.
Yeah, I still dug it. I didn't fully, even when they sort of little by little bring you into what's going on, I even liked the stage of reveals. I was impressed by like how much they held back, how much they give you, and they kind of string you along to like a pretty great conclusion.
Sure.
Yeah, I dug this.
The last one is The House of Seven Gables, which I feel like I had to read in like American literature or something. I feel like I've read this before I saw the movie. But it deals with a family that suffers from a curse and everyone has to come back to the house and divvy up the finances or whatever, essentially. And to me, it's a pretty generic way to get everyone into one house. Sure. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just one of those, like, everyone has to come home now. No real reason. Just come here.
Yeah. Well, I guess there's inheritance at play. And I love the house component. I'm a huge fan of Crimson Peak, and it really borrowed some of the better stuff from the story. It's funny. I had no idea. House of Seven Gables. I had to look up what a gable was. And so here's a little bit for Darren's Architecture Corner. A gable is the part of a wall that supports a pitched roof. So if a roof is the arrow bracket pointing upwards, the gable fills in everything inside. And so House of Seven Gables, it's another way to say a giant fucking house.
It's a big house. And it is a big house. It's actually a beautiful set work.
On property that I guess they describe the like red clay. And this is the sort of where Crimson Peak is borrowing from. Mm-hmm. But this red clay gets in the well water. The clay like seeps into the house's foundation. So like if there's a crack in the wall or portraits that seemingly bleed.
Yes.
Like great visuals there. Great visuals at play.
It's
definitely
a Crimson Peak situation.
Yeah.
So what you have, though, is the sister who's kind of like keeping the house together.
Mm-hmm.
And then Vincent Price shows up. And then just like family arguments. There's no real horror as much as just arguments going on with a family.
Yeah. Well, what better to argue about than money?
I guess
and
it's
inheritances.
True.
And I guess they suspect there's like a treasure somewhere on the property.
Right.
And so, yeah. So the more they talk about money, the more you kind of recognize that, like, Vincent Price's character, he's not the good guy in this story.
No. No, he is the shit-stirring brother, for sure-sies.
I will not be frightened away, Hannah. When I get what I want from this house, then I'll leave, and not before.
Do you think you can outwit a ghost? Are you so immune to death that you can defy a curse that has ruined the Pynchon family?
I'll stay alive as long as is necessary.
You don't have a choice. The man buried under this house won't wait.
Go back to your books of demons and witchcraft. They're your only companions.
Why not? It wasn't the dead who gambled away the family fortunes. And now that you've bankrupted us, you think you can come back here and take what is rightfully mine?
Yours? You assume a great deal, my dear sister.
You'll never find that vault, Gerald. I've searched this house from top to bottom, just as every Pynchon has searched it for 150 years. The ghost won't let you find it.
It isn't where you look for it, Hannah. It's how.
So in the process of looking for the family's treasure, and I guess there's like a lawyer or solicitor who's sort of overlooking the estate, they know there's something in the basement, and when they dig up a family crypt, it turns out, in the basement, where we find the cleanest skeleton, like, devoid of other remains or clothes. It's
right.
As if a naked person was dropped in there. And
maybe. You don't know what goes on in the House of Seven Gables.
I guess it's possible. The cleanliness of the white skeleton was kind of like on par with like the classroom skeleton examples. It was that clean, like it was boiled clean.
Right.
But in this case, it's just one more clue as far as the family's estate and not exactly buried treasure, but it's enough that Vincent Price is now sort of rejuvenated at the idea that there's money to be found.
Right.
And what better to come between family than money? That's a pretty great reaction moment where he sort of absorbs that there is money, there is family money, and I don't feel like sharing.
Yeah. And I don't know, I think there was probably enough to go around, but I guess we'll never know, Vincent Price. So the shit kind of hits the fan, and Vincent Price is actually at his best when it starts to go like bonkers.
Yeah.
And it's kind of this like Fall of the House of Usher kind of idea going on. It's really a lovely set.
Yeah.
And the ending, I'm trying not to spoil it. So I'm having hard times using words because I don't want to spoil it.
There is a final visual that I think only plays because it is Vincent Price and he is bringing his A game. I think anybody else would have gone a different, more hokey way with it. But it works. It works with him.
He's a class act. He, you know what? He can play serious with inanimate objects. He can make it all happen. But he also can play, you know, silly. If you remember The Cask of Amontillado.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the best ones. Or is Black Cat.
Was it Black Cat? Oh, right. It's one and the same as
far as
the Poe stories. Yeah.
Where he can be silly, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this would have been perfect if he was rocking the blonde head of hair from House of Usher in this one, then even better. But otherwise, like I've got no qualms. I really did like each of these segments.
I think Vincent Price is great. He makes the most of whatever is given to him. It's not my favorite because I don't like that none of them have anything to do with each other. Like, I don't like that.
The segments.
Yeah,
don't,
if it's portmanteau, okay. I want there to be some sort of thing that they have in common.
Yeah.
Besides just Nathaniel Hawthorne, you know what I'm saying?
And
Vincent Price. Obviously.
That there were period pieces. That was enough for me. I don't know. I guess I never, with the exception of like literally the Crypt Keeper, I've never really needed, you know, I don't know. I guess I appreciate the creep show comic book wraparounds. I kind of like the cohesiveness that brings to it. And in these being period pieces, that was enough for me. Yeah, I don't ask too much of these anthology movies.
Fair enough.
But they still sometimes fall short, creep show. but yeah, so that'll wrap us up. We're we got through a lot of stories with the I mean, it's thanks to the efficiency of anthology movies, but
it's true.
Yeah, yeah, I dug these for the most part.
I mean, I think they're all worth watching. I wouldn't say skip any of them.
No, none.
Oh, well, I mean, no, you got to watch the whole thing. Like, obviously, yes, I would skip some Creepshow. But you got to watch the whole thing. That's part of life.
Yeah, and I think these
you take the good with the bad.
Yeah. And yeah.
That's the facts of life.
These get better. So that'll do it for this Memorial Day episode on anthology favorites. Definitely a volume one, as even just in looking into these, as far as like Stephen King anthologies, Cat's Eye was one that I grew up with as a kid that like I'm kind of excited to go back and see again. Yeah, there's tons of great stuff. But that'll do it for now. You can always find us on social media. We are at Rance Macabre on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And our email is therantsmacabre@gmail.com. Drop us a line. Let us know what some of your favorite anthology movies or segments are. Ones we might have missed. What else? Yeah. Our website's therantsmacabre.com. I'm trying to save Mindy her voice. She's been a trooper sitting through this long recording with walking pneumonia.
I think maybe next time we record, I'll be better.
Fingers crossed.
Right? Yeah. If not, I'm just going to have this old, like, crotchety old lady voice forever, which will be good. Like, I should yell at people more. Like, tell people to get out of my way.
Frighten children.
Yeah.
Over on Patreon, our newest episode is a rant sequitur, where we talk about something decidedly not horror, except for, no, I'm not going to joke. It was St. Elmo's Fire.
It's good. It's not horror. Fuck you.
I had never seen St. Elmo's Fire. It is a movie near and dear to Mindy's heart, the way Star Wars was for me. And when she watched it in her 30s just recently and talked about it on the show and sort of talked about some of the very curious assumptions that one comes by when they've never watched a Star Wars film, I think same goes for me. I confuse St. Elmo's Fire for Mystic Pizza and any,
right, well,
any number
of 80s. Right, well, because it gets kind of in, like, the national, like, zeitgeist of, you know, of...
Yeah,
Saint
Elmo's Fire
commentary.
Less so, but
well, I don't know.
Rob Lowe and saxophones—they ruled America. Also on Patreon, we've got episodes: Night of Living Dead. We've got a two movie episode where we talk about Romero's original and the remake that Tom Savini directed. We've got an episode on Killer Cars. We've got fully produced episodes. We've got movie watch-alongs. We've got sketches that are exclusive to them. We've got original songs that are also available to them. Our Patreon page is full of goodies. Check it out for $1 a month. You can join the club and get... on average, we're getting 2 exclusive pieces a month for Patreon subscribers. So we could use the help. Join us over there at patreon.com/rantsmacabre. That'll do it for me. This is me, Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.